This is a podcast from Consilio. We bring people together to create better places.
Hello and welcome to Better Places. A new episode and a new year. Happy 2024. This is the podcast where we talk about planning, politics and something else. Property.
Property, right?
Yeah,
property.
From across the capital.
Development, if you want.
And development, yeah, all sorts of things. And so happy new year to everyone. I'm here with Oscar Harmon from our team here at Consilio. Say hello, Oscar.
Hello, happy new year, everyone.
And an old but new face, Sidhu Dwyer.
Yeah, I think so. Probably about 6 stone smaller.
Not going to comment on your waistline, but safe to say, you used to be here at Consilio, and you've since been doing all sorts of other things at the centre of, I guess, Labour politics in London.
Central London, perhaps.
What have you been doing, Sidhu?
What have I been
since you left us 4 years ago, pre-pandemic?
Long years ago. I mean, so I've spent some time in Parliament, which was quite an eventful couple years. In fact, setting up Tyrol Temi MP's office, I'd only just started in, it was March 2020.
Oh, yeah, so... Wow. Just after the 2019 election.
Indeed.
Complete
wipeout for my party. And
it's all right, you're about to get it back, so it doesn't matter.
Well.
And some.
Well, indeed. But fingers crossed, no complacency. But no, I think it was, so I've spent a couple years or so in Parliament working to support Tyrol Temi, who was...
She was the MP for...
Coventry North West.
There we go.
Second most marginal Tory Labour seat in the country.
Is that right?
Indeed, but hopefully, if the party or the polls for the Labour Party are to be believed, she will be returned with a decent working majority for her constituents, because she's a hard-working MP. And then went on to support My Life, My Say. In their kind of efforts to engage young people in politics, before landing a role in the leader of Lambeth Council's office, supporting the cabinet members for housing and then planning and regeneration and healthy communities. So busy days, and yeah, glad to be back.
Welcome back indeed to Consilio. Yeah, lots of, I guess we'll hear from you quite a lot this year, different episodes of this podcast.
Well, yeah, hopefully.
See which guests you can rustle up. And speaking of guests, who have we got on the show today, Oscar?
So we are very grateful to have James Asser and James Beckles on the show today, which made getting the name right difficult. But we managed.
Two Jameses.
The two Jameses, yep. Looking up and saying, James, if I can come to you, and then realising they don't know who I'm speaking to. So James Asser, who is Chair of Labour's ruling National Executive Committee, Deputy Mayor of Newham and Cabinet Member for Environment and Sustainable Transport. And James Beckles, who is a Newham councillor as well, Chair of their local development committee, a member of the LLDC planning committee, and is aspiring to be one of Labour's candidates for the London wide assembly list later this year.
So a very big Newham special, but also I guess a rising star in the Labour Party as well. So quite an interesting interview. 2024, big year. We normally start by talking about the news, but there's been so much of it and so much other stuff going on that I think it's probably worth just having a look at what's going to come up this year, because it's a mega year politically. Quite aside from what's happening in the UK, I actually read that it's the most polled year in the world.
It is indeed.
Something like 4 billion people will get to cast a vote this year.
Goodness.
Which, you know, can you imagine if you're running the campaigns for all of them? Quite busy.
Imagine being the other 3 billion.
I wonder how many of them are legitimate votes as well, and how many are just...
Oh, God, you're going on Trumpian on us.
No. I was more thinking about, you know, other dictatorships rather than what Trump's trying to engineer in America.
Well, actually, I think it's a great year for democracy, actually.
I agree. A great year for democracy. Yeah. And, you know, no less great for London and the UK, of course, because in May we've got the mayoral and GLA election. So I always think Sadiq's term we only just had an election, but it's because, of course, COVID meant that he ended up having the 5-year term and then a 3-year term. Mm. So it has been eight years of Sadiq. So we'll see what happens in May there. If polls are to be believed, it'll be a landslide victory for Sadiq. He almost doesn't even have to bother campaigning.
If Susan Hall's campaign carries on the way it does, I think she may not. But actually, on a serious note, I think it will be quite an interesting contest, not least because it is now 2 years, 2 terms of Sadiq's kind of tenure. He's run on quite a strong platform, but there's of course the issue of ULEZ.
Yeah.
Well, we managed to get into the office today, but of course strikes and some industrial action that has affected people across London. And I think, well, it depends on when the election is and
the general election,
or the little contest there. Depending on when the election is, that will certainly either spur turnout or different camps.
And also, it means he's standing as well, I guess, right?
Yeah, I think it's quite a difficult one, because at the same time as the Labour Party nationally are fighting an election on its time for change, and there being this real push for, you know, I mean, I think on the same day as the Uxbridge by-election, we had the by-election in North.
Oh, Shelby and Anstey.
Shelby and Anstey. There we go.
Come on, guys.
And
come on.
Very London centric gang we've got here.
Yeah. And on the same day as we lost Uxbridge, we won Keir Mather's seat, right?
Yeah.
And that, I think, shows that this election is going to be, you know, Labour trying to make the general election about it being time for change, and the Conservatives doing the exact opposite. The exact same thing, but against a Sadiq in London.
Yeah, I think that's fair. I also think in London it depends who stands against Sadiq. You know, are there independents who stand, and how does that work? So, anyway, I think we'll do a whole special episode on the London elections and what's going to happen there. But, yeah, as we've said, the other small contest coming up is, of course, the general election. Day one of this year, I think it was kind of in all the papers, when's it going to be? The Prime Minister came out with a very, very decisive, it is my working assumption, it'll be in the second half of this year.
How many focus groups do you think he...
I don't think it's that I don't think it's that calculated. I think it's two things. One is he probably hasn't fully decided yet, because how can you don't know where things are going to go, and it is one of the things that's very much within his gift. And the other thing is, damned if he doesn't really, because up until May everyone's going to be saying, you know, call the election, why aren't you ruling it out, when is it going to be? And then if he did not call it in May, he'd be seen to be bottling it then. So at least he can kind of manage expectations now by saying that it's going to be in the latter half of the year.
6 months.
Personally, I don't know why anyone thinks it wouldn't be in the latter half of the year.
No, I certainly agree.
Well, when do we all think it's going to be? Oscar, when do you think?
Well, I think if he suffers really badly in the... So let's say, hypothetically speaking, you know, gets to, I think it's March the... it's maybe about the 18th or a couple of weeks before, where he's the deadline where he has to call an election for it to be on May the 2nd. And let's say he doesn't call that election on that date, and we know, therefore, it's going to be in June, October, November, right? If in that election in May, the Conservatives suffer quite difficult and damaging defeats in a lot of those local elections, what does that do to morale in the Conservative Party? What does that do to a lot of the MPs when they lose seats in areas where they are standing in a few months in the general? And what does it do to the activists on the ground?
I can tell you, morale at the Conservative Party is already pretty low, so I'm not sure another round of defeats is going to do much to change it. And most of the narrative is going to be in London, where... frankly, there's no seats for the Conservatives to defend in the local elections. So I could take the argument, but I think it's less of a problem than it might otherwise be. But also, you know, you don't give up that job willingly. He, you know, all the signs are the economy is starting to improve, things are getting better. And ultimately, if people start to feel that, he's going to leave it as long as possible, I would have thought. Yeah. But the only one caveat to all of this is that, you know, I think that there are so many divisions popping up all over the place within the party at the moment. And, you know, there's a lot of legislation he's got to get through over the next few months that could create even more divisions. And it's kind of whether it's the only mechanism that he can see to keep the party in line is to call a general election or threaten to call a general election. Then I can see how that might be the case. But I also think that, you know, it's within his gift. MPs don't even have to vote for it anymore. The fixed-term parliament actually gone. It's literally his decision. And I'm not sure that, you know, if the current polls don't move, why any Conservative MP would be up for having one.
So, I was thinking about this earlier. From a Labour perspective, I was thinking about this. Do you think that Keir would want it to be sooner rather than later?
Well, if the polls are anything to believe, yes. But actually... in my view, I think no party is really ready at the moment.
No, I don't think anyone's ready.
No, and Nathan and I were talking about this just before. I mean, in order to select the amount of candidates that we need to get the parties in the right place, if you look at the government, they've got a whole raft of legislation that they want to get through. They want to see the economy improved. For the Labour Party, although we say we're election ready, I think we largely are. We've got a number of candidates that we need to get in place, and actually. cynically, you'd probably want the government to run out of steam a little bit. If it gets to about November and the public are feeling that this has gone on way too long, there would be a chance to have that kind of positive narrative there. But actually, I think this election may well be one where people are voting out of the sake of, well, frankly, quite tired of the Tory party, that they want to see some element of change. And actually, it may even be an argument of, well, can they do any worse than this lot?
Yeah, I guess on the same sense, you've got the longer it lasts, the longer that, you know, Sunak has, the more time there is for there to be those green shoots of recovery that you mentioned. But there's also the longer, more opportunities for them to make mistakes, or for division to show, or for, you know, issues to not be solved.
Can't make many more, can they?
Well, you've got, you know, the whole summer.
I think the whole people crying out for change thing is obviously a really powerful message at the moment. And, you know, there's no doubt that, you know, that is reflected in all the by-election results. It's reflected in the last set of local elections. It's also reflected in just turnout in terms of, you know, traditional Conservative voters just staying at home and not bothering to vote, because even they can accept the fact that something needs to change. I think in a general election campaign, the whole question becomes, OK, you accept that there needs to be a change, but what change to what?
Sure.
And the intensity of a general election year, and I remember this in 2015 and to a lesser extent in 17 and 19 because they were snap generals, but that campaign and the intensity of it means that you really do have to articulate what your plan for change is actually going to be. And I think actually the more time Labour have to do that, the better it will be for Labour, because it's almost like, okay, fine, you accept the fact that the Labour Party has changed, it's moved on from Corbyn, you accept the fact that the country wants change. It's now part three, which will ultimately, I think, decide whether Keir Starmer's prime minister or not, is, or how big the majority is, is what does that change actually look like? And I don't know that anyone can answer that yet. But as soon as we can, that's the time you want to go to the polls, right?
Yeah. I think that, yeah, I'm with you, Nathan. I think my instinct is the prime minister will want to serve as prime minister for as long as possible. You know, if he thinks it's a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity and he won't get the chance to do it again, I think stay as long as you can. Yeah.
2 years of the grand rate, I think.
I do actually wonder whether or not it's possible to do that job for longer than 2 years these days. The intensity of being, it's a whole other conversation.
Historically, prime ministers haven't really lasted that long. I mean, you do have Lord, I think it's Liverpool, that did about 15 years. Obviously, you've got Thatcher, and things can only get better, Mr. Blair. But that's quite rare. Most prime ministers only
Cameron
really
did
ever,
six.
I did six. I mean, six, around 3 to 6 years. I'm not saying that that's an ideal amount of time, but this idea that prime ministers should go on for long periods of time is perhaps not something that, that we should really get used to. But the country does need stability.
I'd be interested to see how many of the longer-serving prime ministers have actually done a full stint as leader of the opposition before they get into it. Because it's pretty clear to me that Keir's changed massively from when he took on the role of leader of the opposition 5 years ago to where he is now, just in terms of presentation, discipline, order. He's, you know, he looks much more like a seasoned politician. And in the same way as when Cameron stood in the Rose Garden in 2010 and formed a coalition with Nick Clegg, he had the benefit of 5 years of leader of the opposition under his belt. And I do wonder whether you don't have that experience, whether or not the whole job becomes much harder, regardless. Gordon Brown, Theresa May.
Well, if there's any budding historians out there, you can always drop me an email. sdwyer@castillocomms.com.
There you
answer go. Nathan's question.
There we go. Right, anyway, let's crack on and get on with the interview. But yeah, look forward to speaking to everybody at a future episode very soon.
I'm delighted to be joined by my colleague Oscar from Consilio, and both James Asser and James Beckles from the London Borough of Newham. So welcome, everyone.
Thank you very much.
Perhaps I'll kick off with some introductions. James Asser?
Hello, I'm James Asser. I'm a councillor in the London Borough of Newham. I'm the deputy mayor and the cabinet member for Environment and Sustainable Transport. I'm also the chair of the Labour Party National Executive.
Welcome, James.
And I'm James Beckles. I'm chair of the Local Development Committee, and I'm also a member on the London Legacy Development Corporation.
It's great to kickstart the new year with two wonderful guests from East London. And I see Newham, but particularly Stratford, as being the kind of beating heart of East London. And I wonder what you both saw as the future of Newham and what this new chapter brings, both in new administration, but what the new year will bring for this corner of East London.
Well, Stratford is one of the not only the busiest terminals in London. I think it's the fourth busiest station in the country. It also has a fantastic opportunity for regeneration, not just in homes, but also the landscape, town centre regeneration. So it offers, you know, jobs, skills, all those things that go along really well and succinctly with regeneration projects. But it's also a chance to actually enliven an area like Newham, which has so much going on for it, especially in the Stratford area, and outside of the Olympic Park, which I think gets a lot of focus on. And having this opportunity for regen, jobs, skills, and also opening up our train station, which is very busy and can look slightly tired, it's an opportunity just to bring that alive and actually make Newham much more of a beacon borough.
Yeah, and I think lots of people will know Newham, particularly for Stratford, especially post-Olympics and the huge amount of development gone on there. But actually, if you move south down the borough, there are vast amounts of spaces that are coming up for regeneration, particularly down in the docks. I don't think if you'd have said to somebody in the mid-80s when they were starting on Canary Wharf that project would be a 60-year plan that would slowly work its way east, anyone would have thought of it like that. But that's where we've got to, and there's lots of work starting in the kind of south of the borough around the old docks, around particularly around the Royal Victoria Dock, but plans coming through for the other ones too, and there's sort of 10 years of sort of growth and regeneration there. So I think if we were doing this in 10 years' time, we'd be looking back at this and talking about the south of the borough as having been transformed, and in the same way we're talking about Stratford now. So there's lots of exciting stuff coming up.
I think just touching on that and its proximity to Canary Wharf, there's a perception that developments like those don't necessarily benefit local people. What would you say are the markers that you've set down in administration for new developments that will come forward, James?
I think that's important. And when I got elected in 2018, certainly there was development going on, which was there was concerns around residents on estates nearby to make sure that they were getting some benefits from it. And I think that's something we're very aware of. I mean, James B and I, which is how we have to kind of do this, we are used to this over the last 5 years, probably have kind of different perspectives on the way we look at this, because James through his planning role and me with my environment role, because whilst I don't take decisions, I do get consulted an awful lot because they have to get my input on kind of environment stuff. And one of the key things we talk to them about is about what is it going to look like for local people? How is it going to fit into the area? How is it going to blend in and add to the kind of wider summer stuff in terms of, you know, facilities and green spaces and all those kind of things in the past, where perhaps, you know, if you go back and look at some of those campaigns that were run back in the 80s, it was very much here's a new city planting in the middle, but actually it has to blend in and it has to kind of benefit local people too. And that's something we're very keen on.
Yeah, similar to what James Hayes said, you know, we're both councillors in the south of the borough, Jameson, Beckton, and me in Custom House. And if you look at Custom House, it's very different to our neighbouring ward of Canning Town. Less developed, slightly more low-rise, but that's starting to change. Recently at planning decision, a planning committee, strategic development, we've given permission to develop 650 homes, but alongside that decision didn't just come around overnight. We've had to work a lot with the community. We started up a regeneration steering group, and we involved the community around Custom House, especially around the key regeneration area. And the south of the borough does sometimes feel slightly neglected. Yes, you might have XL and you might have the Royal Docks development, but you've got other areas such as Custom House, such as Silvertown, which don't get the added, I'd say, love and attention that they probably need and deserve. So in Custom House, we're going to see 650 new homes. It's going to be the regeneration of a high street. It's going to bring in new residents, as well as not just relocating others, but also make sure that they have a right of return, which was very key to, I think, the planning application success, especially for me as a local councillor, and also being on strategic development and making that decision, was that residents were involved at every single step of the way, and that they ultimately are making the decisions, and we are seeing this regeneration program come through. And I think that's a testament to the administration, the hard work that's been done there, and also to the hard work of residents who've worked with us as councillors and as an authority to see this development come through.
Have you found steering groups a kind of helpful tool in shaping developments, and what kind of added benefits do you think any developers coming into the borough would find in bringing communities in much earlier?
Yeah, I found the steering group to be very helpful, and I say it in two parts. One is the local councillor, and the second part that my ward colleague, Sarah Ruiz, is chair of the Regeneration Steering Group, and has been very much a ear and a friend of residents and listening to their views. Steering groups offer an important, I guess, resident voice, especially to developers, and saying, you know, we want to be carried along in this decision. We don't want it to be done to us, but, you know, with us involved. I think it's key that any sort of scheme actually, you know, goes beyond, the traditional means of consultation, whether it's a website or just having a one-day or two-day event, but actually involve residents along the way in that journey, understanding this is what the development is, this is how it's going to benefit you, and these are both the physical and the social aspects that will help, hopefully, improve your lives. I mean, and I say hopefully because it's never certain, but with residents involved, they're at least more educated, more aware outside of the professional space of developers, consultees, and professional consultation companies.
Yeah, I mean, I've been less involved, it's slightly my side of the patch, but I think, I mean, certainly our current mayor is very keen on transparency and public involvement, and I think that helps. I think there's always a nervousness. Politicians get kind of, God, we're going to be shouted at, and often with developers, you know, we're going to come with a plan. Actually, if you... most of problems come from people not being aware of what's happened and fear of what they don't know happening. Mm. I think you'll find that most people want to live in a nice area with nice facilities and nice housing. They will be able to tell you what the problems are, and they're pretty frank in terms of telling you what is wrong with the place. And actually, you can learn an awful lot from residents by asking them. They'll tell you what you think you know, but actually give you a bit more detail. And if you're clear with them what your plans are, there'll be bits they don't like, but actually you can end up shaping them. And I think we all, as a kind of, you know, as an industry, as a political process, just need to be a bit more relaxed about how we manage that and engaging with people. We know there are always groups that kind of like to jump on these things and run bandwagons, but actually residents are usually pretty strong-minded in terms of knowing what they would like to see, what their problems are, and you can make real progress with that engagement. And sometimes you have to do a bit of, well, okay, we're going to have to let everybody tell us what's wrong first, because often they haven't been heard for a long time. There's a bit of kind of, if we need an hour meeting, let's have a tour meeting, let the first hour just everyone kind of get off their chest, everything's wrong. Mm. And actually in the second hour you make progress and build from there. And we've done it with a number of other kind of projects outside of development, and it does work, and it is bringing people with us, and you find those kind of gems in the community will kind of help do a bit of legwork for you and things going. So I think everyone needs to be a bit less nervous and kind of brave it a bit more. Which is always a big ask, because sometimes it can be difficult, but actually the end product is worth it.
I see Newham as being somewhere that has the kind of outer London characteristics of being quite suburban, but then you have areas of the borough like Stratford and parts of the south that kind of more inner city in look and feel. How would you kind of characterise the different areas of the borough, and how a developer or even the council, and how it approaches development, and how do you characterise those different parts of Newham?
I think it's difficult, because particularly over the development over the last few years, Newham is lots of different places, and I think it's true of London. People talk about London, actually, as we know, it's not just 32 boroughs, it's the bits within that. And you know, if you go from East Ham, it's Victorian Terrace, you're up to Stratford, it's modern new build, you go down to where I am in Beckton in the south of Borough, it's all 80s regeneration, and there's lots and lots of variation. I think the thing you're interesting you say about kind of the inner outer thing, there's a little bit of legacy, because we were the boundary. You know, West Ham was in the old London boundaries, East Ham was out in Essex. And there is still an element of that. I mean, to be honest, most of it these days we need to be regarded as inner London, and we're not full of finance, which makes it very difficult. But there is a lot of variation, and you can almost sort of see with about the fact there is a road called Boundary Road kind of helps you point to where it is. As well. But there's still, it's interesting how those legacies last, to be honest. So, but in terms of where we need to be reviewed, we are very much in terms of density and size of population, because we are now the third most populous borough and growing fast. We've just done a boundary commission review, and they kind of do a bit of future proofing now. We expect to go up to the second most populous borough. So in terms of where we need to be regarded, we're an inner London borough just because of the sheer scale of the size of the population and the growth we've got coming.
Yeah, and I would agree with everything you've said there, James. I would also argue that internally there is a bit of a north-south divide, and that divide is pretty much along the A13, which cuts through the borough. So, you know, below Canning Town, you've got the A13, which splits the borough. And a lot of people, especially in our patches that we represent, will often say development and the focus of the council is often on the north side. So it's kind of changing that psychology as well, and also saying, you know, we are one borough and we are trying to work on these issues. In terms of that outer London, inner London feel, yes, you know, we're affected by a lot of what you'd consider inner London difficulties, whether it might be, you know, knife crime or congestion and everything else. But in terms of outer London, in terms of funding, you know, we get somewhat of a raw deal, and yet we're dealing with, you know, a large population, a diverse population. By no means, I would say, is Newham characterised by outer London NIMBYism. You know, we are quite a development friendly borough that wants to develop and wants to see these things, but it has to be development that's right for the borough and right for the council and right for our residents ultimately.
Yeah, it's worth saying we're sliced into to thirds because we have the district line and the main lines going through at the top, which chops the top third off. That's easier because it's public transport, but a six-lane motorway on one of the trunk roads out does create real issues in an actual physical barrier, because it's difficult to build bridges and cross that, so it has kind of segregated it, which makes it harder.
It's interesting, James, you mentioned development and speaking about how you view Newham as very much a development-friendly borough within London, which I'm sure is music to the ears of many people listening to this. So you've been chair of the Local Development Committee since May of last year. I'd like to delve a bit more into that. Obviously, we're here at Consilio, we watch a lot of planning committees and monitor them for different applications and see what kind of themes and debates come up. How have you found your experience as chair of the Local Development Committee? Have you enjoyed it? Have you found it challenging? What are the kind of opportunities about it, do you think?
I do enjoy development and do enjoy being chair of local development. And one of the big issues for me coming into it has been, you know, upskilling the committee. You know, I guess if you read, you know, briefs and you get information, a lot of development committees are sometimes a little bit haphazard. They're put together. People might not want to do it. They don't necessarily choose planning. But I think you have to have a commitment to ensuring that what we are deciding is ultimately right for our residents, and I think that's what I've tried to instill in the planning committee, or at least my one, because we also have strategic development, which deals with larger schemes, which I sit on as a ordinary member. So I'm very much in favour of having good applications that come before that, and also having my committee challenge those applications, even where they are put forward by the council or external developers, that we have that critical role. It's a quasi-judicial it's a quasi-judicial applications and committee. So therefore, we have a legal right to do that, and also a legal framework in which we have to operate in. So make sure that we make the right decision, or as right as we can be, is very key to me. And also seeing good schemes go through and make sure that our residents ultimately benefit from it. So if you watch, the committee's always trying to encourage a lot of debate and arguments and critical thinking and critical questions there. So I've enjoyed it. I like, you know, quizzing developers, like quizzing about applications, sometimes a bit nerdy in that sense, kind of going, you know, into the detail of it. But I think it's important that we do that and we show that we're keen to get the right sort of schemes coming through and approved at committee, and also challenging those which are deemed to not be ready or not to be approved as well.
I think that's really interesting. In relation to housing in particular, obviously a key challenge across London, and more over the last year or so has gone into the forefront of both political debate, but obviously always occupies a huge amount of thought of local opinion. Without obviously going into specifics about applications, what would you say has been the biggest barrier from the kind of local planning committee's perspective in relation to delivering the new homes that Newham needs. What have been the biggest challenges whereby committee members have broadly speaking gone, this looks great, you know, lots of new homes proposed as a part of this application, but actually because of A, B and C, we're not inclined to give it our approval at this stage?
I would say definitely the delivery of affordable housing has been a huge barrier. Sometimes a scheme, it might be compliant, but then you've got a development where you've got one block which is private, another block which is social rent or affordable housing. It could be intermediate, whether it's shared ownership. I think that, you know, some of the committee members look at each other quizzically, think, should we approve this scheme? Mm-hmm. It might be given, it might be written down as an approval, but we have to challenge it and we say, what more can we do to get more out of this scheme? In terms of design as well, I think we've got a quality review panel that goes through those applications. We want to see the best quality, not just, you know, a 26 story tower and somewhat of a block, but something that's actually going to be creative and say, this is a landmark building that you're bringing here and we want our residents to benefit ultimately from that. So those are the areas I would say from a committee stage we're always looking at: quality of design, you know, how does it interact with the local community, how has it involved the local community, but also can we look at mixed communities and mixed tenure. Slightly old-fashioned about these ideas, but I think it's very important now. We want Newham to be as an inclusive place as possible, and one of the things that I guess I learned on the LDC and I kind of bring to the fore in Newham's planning is about pepper potting and always asking about it. So I think we need to build mixed communities, mixed tenure. That's important for social integration, but also how Newham looks in the long term.
I think on social integration, but also inclusive growth, one of the best ways of achieving that is through affordable housing, but also social housing. I know that the borough is currently consulting and working through its estate regeneration programme, and I wonder if you could touch on the Carpenter estate and how you found that development coming forward, but also some of the challenges in bringing forward new affordable homes in this kind of quite fervent economic climate.
I think one of the big challenges is the sheer amount of time it's needed to deal with this. It's been sat there a long time, particularly when you've got developments around it, because it's up in Stratford, for people who don't know where it is, and you've got what is a kind of a very typical sort of 60s style tower block estate surrounded by new regeneration, which kind of emphasises the kind of problems it's had. And it, you know, lots of people have moved out, but there are people who still want to stay there. And so getting that balance right on kind of regenerating it, but also providing, linking the community, which is, you know, the stuff James was talking about what does it bring to local areas, it is quite important. And it's taken a long time. We've had some other estates around the other bits of the borough which are a similar way. These things can take a long time. And the problem is, as they go on, you tend to get a decline in the areas. People are kind of waiting, so aren't going to invest because they don't know what's coming, and speeding up. So that kind of pace, and this is the same I've worked in other boroughs where it's been the same problem, is that pace is the problem, really. And you do need to try and keep it up and keep things moving, but that does provide a huge challenge in terms of kind of maintaining it whilst you're getting to the point of what the final plan looks like.
And I've seen those challenges in Lambeth, where we've been trying to progress 6 state regens all at the same time, which can be quite challenging for local authorities. So we've seen that the commitment to a ballot, giving residents a say, and what can come forward is something that can certainly bring people in. Also being realistic, as you've said, James, in terms of the time it's going to take, the pace of delivery, also nailing down those commitments that residents want to see in terms of, you know, this return back to their home, or making sure that those properties are properly accessible to whoever lives there. I wonder if you could touch on calls for either retrofitting or rebuilding the estate, and how the council sought to kind of engage with residents who do not feel that we should regenerate in that.
I mean, it's been a lot of engagement with both residents and residents groups. And the problem with all these kind of things is you're always going to get that kind of splitting views, particularly when it's been there waiting some kind of work for a long time. I think the key thing is you just have to eventually come up with a balance of what is doable, but also what is affordable. Money is a huge part in all of this, particularly as in the last couple of years with inflation, everything is making life much, much harder. We've got a balance there with there's some kind of replacement and there is some kind of retrofitting. And I think essentially you have to look at what the assets there you've got, what are the state. I mean, sometimes there is just no choice. it is cheaper to demolish it. The state of the building is, it needs to be replaced. In others, you can change it. It's also trying to create modern homes and that will meet the kind of need of people now, because families have changed, things are different. So it's, I think it's trying to get that balance and trying to hear people's views, but also trying to get something that is going to work for everybody and build a new community and expand on what we've already got. And it is a huge challenge to get that balance right, and we've done a lot of engagement with a lot of people to get to that point.
The towers were structurally sound. If you look at carpenters, the building was fine. I think it just suffered a lot from not being invested in, not having the right resources actually allocated to it. And when you actually spoke to residents in that particular area around the carpenter's estate, they had a love and affinity for actually keeping the building, keeping their estate. They didn't want it to be demolished. They wanted to stay, or at least be returned to where they lived in the past. So politically, there was that decision made about keeping the carpenters and actually investing council money into regenerating it, and also using GLA funds as well. I think the ballot was a good opportunity to engage residents, also gauge their views about what's happened, challenge some of the negative perceptions about the estate and about the council's intentions, and say that this is what we want to do. We want to keep residents involved. We want to save, a much loved but underinvested building, and actually bring it back into use and repopulate it. If you go to Carpenter's Estate, you have very few families in there. I would say you've got probably under 20. So you've got this huge building. You've got maybe under 20, if that's the correct figure. You may need to verify that for yourself. And bringing it back and getting more of our residents in there. So I think that's testament to our commitment and our work with residents to actually do that and support and regenerate an existing estate rather than building a brand new one, which might have had probably more negative connotations with our residents.
Absolutely agree, and of course it's on a case-by-case basis and whether there's a financial case that can be made, but ultimately, as you said, it's about creating new homes and new places for people to live, or at least increasing the number of homes that are there.
Looking at the LLDC, the London Legacy Development Corporation, obviously established in 2012 following the Olympics. I know, James, you sit as a member of the planning committee that the LLDC operate. Over the last, what is it now, 12 years now, I keep forgetting which year it is, do you think that's been a success overall?
I think in development terms, it has been a success. Okay. If you look at a lot of the new developments that are coming through, whether it's the East Bank development, the International Quarter, there's a lot happening, and it's going to be a landmark scheme, landmark development. We were very lucky to have the Olympics back in 2012 and make sure that legacy was continued. I think myself and other elected members that sit on there from Newham, Waltham Forest, Tower Hamlets and Hackney, what we're concerned about is the delivery of affordable housing and housing that would meet the needs of our residents, especially with our large waiting list. And in Newham, we've got 34,000 people on the waiting list. So it's huge. And I've got probably the unenviable reputation, along with some other elected members, having voted against the East Bank decision. So hopefully BBC, V&A, no hard feelings, but it was about one of the key decisions, and they had the portfolio approach, was about the delivery of affordable housing on the same site as East Bank, so BBC, V&A, UAL, University Arts London, and having affordable housing there. And that, to us, was quite a key area. And I think that the LLDC, especially the Planning Decisions Committee, has somewhat failed in delivering the number of affordable housing that I think London needs, and especially that area crucially needs. We have to be in the business of delivering houses that Londoners can live in, whether it's Londoners with a lot of disposable income and those of less disposable income, but need a good quality house which doesn't discriminate, so no poor doors. Mm. And the LDC can be good at, saying, this is what our plan is. We want to deliver high quality buildings, which they do. However, in terms of delivery of affordable housing, they've somewhat under-delivered. But in terms of the infrastructure, in terms of the landmark schemes, legacy, they've I would say that, you know, they have been a success, and it's testament to the hard work and also, I guess, the visions of both, you know, of both mayors that have come through, both in Newham and also in City Hall, that we have a scheme and projects that are coming through that will hopefully uplift the local areas of the surrounding legacy boroughs.
I think it would be remiss of me not to mention the sphere. I wonder if you could touch on that and how you found...
There's a sphere?
Well, what sphere? How you found that deliberation and the kind of controversy that surrounded it, and whether you think that something of the sort could potentially come forward in Newham again.
Yeah, the sphere, what can I say about it? It was highly contentious as a planning application, you know, being on the committee, I went to a number of different consultations about it. We heard from MSG. They presented it, you know, very well. So that's testament to them. But it was probably the wrong application and the wrong sort of infrastructure that the borough needed, and in the wrong area. You know, can you imagine you'd wake up from your room, you'd look out the window, and you've got this huge glowing orb outside.
Assuming you could get to sleep in the first place.
Yes, exactly. You can get to sleep. And, you know, and... to I guess the recourse to that was just to have blackout blinds, and a number of us elected councils were like, come on, that can't be right, you know, how can you have this scheme doing that? And yes, there were arguments around the economics of it, having it as a landmark destination, this fantastic entertainment district, but it was just the wrong application in the wrong place. I wouldn't necessarily say I was against MSG, but the number of residents that came to us and said, you know, how will I sleep? You're going to reduce the property of my house. You know, the decant from the MSG sphere is going to have an impact on Stratford, but also surrounding stations like Maryland. It was the wrong application. You know, I'm quite proud to say that I voted against it, even though it went through, and I'm pleased that Sadiq Khan called it in and has looked at it. And my plea would be to Michael Gove is to, you know, MSG are already thinking about selling the land, so there's no need to call it in. And I think we need to look at other new developments going forward for that particular location.
I mean, I think if your part of your commitment is you're going to give everyone blackout blinds, you're tacitly admitting there might be a problem. And I think there's a problem with your argument there. And I think there's been some sort of element that will push back from those in favour saying, oh, it was anti-entertainment venues. That's really not the case. The problem here, just this kind of the scale of it and the light pollution, because we've got other great entertainment venues and it's grown, you know, ABBA has been a huge success in the same area. It's just that, you know, we want to attract businesses and investment and entertainment, but you have to take into account the local community and the people that live there as well. And there has to be, you're always trying to strike a balance, and this wasn't going anywhere near striking a balance. And there were real, real concerns, and understandably so. I think, you know, we've got to the right place, assuming Michael Gove doesn't do something crazy.
Well, I think we'll come to find Mr. Gove's decision shortly.
Indeed. So looking ahead, 2024, obviously an incredibly important year for planning and development, but of course for politics as well. We'll come on to the national position in a moment in relation to the general election. But James, it's no secret you're obviously putting your name forward to be Labour's candidate for the Assembly on the list. Tell us a bit about why you're running, what your pitch is, what your priorities are.
Okay, so I'm passionate about London. I think there's been a lot of negativity lately, and I'm quite pleased to speak up for our city, talk about the good things that we've accomplished as a Labour-run city under Sadiq Khan. One of my big areas is, you know, regeneration, but it's also about affordable housing, also the health of our residents and the people that live in the capital. You know, we can debate about, you know, clean air and ULEZ and all these other areas, but I do think, you know, you have to be ambitious and you have to look to the future, and that's what my campaign is about. It's about the future of London and for all Londoners. We've seen that a lot of young families especially have left the capital. If you look at Hackney, you know, they're closing primary schools because they can't get enough kids in those schools. So it's about having affordable housing, allowing those families to remain, but also looking at infrastructure overall. You know, we've got aging streets, and I'm sure James, you know, he deals with a lot of other areas like potholes and streets in Newham. Would value having more direction, probably more funding as well, and having and being able to make that call from City Hall would be a key part of my campaign. But it's also good to be running just to raise, I guess, the profile of this of the London Assembly, which can often be hidden. People might know their MP, they might know the mayor, but they don't necessarily know that they're represented by London Assembly members who represent the different areas of London and who are quite passionate about reducing knife crime, about affordable housing, improving our infrastructure, improving the health of our region. So I would, you know, welcome any suggestions, comments, and votes, of course, and look forward to running in that wherever I place on the list.
Fantastic. And then particularly, so obviously you've got a role at the local level in Newham, the LLDC, and you mentioned the London Assembly can sometimes be perhaps mystified for lots of people in London. They, like you say, they know the councillors, their MP, etc., but maybe not their Assembly member, but maybe they might not even know what the Assembly does. How do you see the GLA in relation to delivering London's housing targets over the next few years?
I think it's a key area. It definitely offers scrutiny to the London mayor. It looks at his, from finances to regeneration housing, looks at those targets. Are they ambitious enough? Are they meeting the needs of Londoners? It has its own planning and housing and regeneration committee, which scrutinises those areas very carefully and looks at, you know, can we be more ambitious? And I think that's quite key to have that body there. It's a consultative body. You know, of course, the Mayor of London can do whatever he wants. He's got executive powers. However, I think having members who represent London and London's constituencies is important. It's a great scrutiny role, and it's a great way to raise the voices of all Londoners and raising those to the London mayor.
There's another little contest that's going to take place this year in the form of the general election. And Prime Minister Rishi Sunak has fired the starting gun for the election, so that it will be at some point in the second half of this year. I wonder, James Asser, in your role as chair of Labour's ruling National Executive Committee, how you see the general election shaping up, how planning, redevelopment and house building will play a part in that, and whether, in your view, Labour's position of being the party of the builders, not the blockers, will kind of ride them to success.
Well, firstly, I don't believe the Prime Minister when he says it's the latter half of the year. I noticed the wording was a working assumption, which sounded like a lot of wiggle room. People have been on board with it in the spring. I've been saying it's the spring for at least a year now, and I haven't changed my mind, and I don't believe him. I don't think he can get through to the autumn. I think there's too many pitfalls for him. But he may just cling on. It could be fingernail marks down the door, on the doorstep of Downing Street. I think it is going to be a housing particularly is going to be a hugely important thing. It's been coming up in general election after general election for some time. I mean, I remember up in the 2015 one, it comes up a lot. People are genuinely extremely concerned about access to housing, about the costs of it. You often meet people who are concerned their children, their grandchildren are having to move away simply because that's the only way they can afford to buy a move. Housing is my biggest issue in terms of my casework. I imagine James will say the same, both in terms of affordability but also social housing. It's something that just hasn't been grasped for a long time. So I think the messaging around actually we're going to push forward with this, and particularly when you've seen the current government has been kind of bending over to it, it's about benches and this kind of nimbyish, or we can't have build. It's reached, this can't be kicked down the road any longer. There is a real crisis on housing. The announcements around new towns, I think, is particularly interesting because it's going back to an old idea, but the one hasn't been used for a good 50 years, but actually one that works very well and starts to deal with some of that issue. But I think it's a big concern for voters. It kind of flies under the radar a bit because whenever you look, it's always NHS, education, crime, for all the obvious reasons. But I think a real concern about people's families and lives and their future and their prospects does sit around this issue, and I think it is a huge concern for people.
What would you say to people who say that the kind of housing crisis is a kind of London focused issue? You look at the Chesterfield and Amersham by election, in which the kind of position around HS2 and the kind of construction of new infrastructure and housing was a particular issue for those kind of middle income voters. How would Labour sell its kind of new EMB position?
It's definitely not a London issue. I think, you know, one of the joys of my job is I go around the country a lot, go to lots of different places. I have done, you know, I've been doing this for 30 years. I've campaigned in most elections in that time. It comes up everywhere, but often, you know, smaller towns. As I say, because people are concerned that families are being split up and have to move up because they just can't access it. It is obviously an acute problem in London for its own reasons. And, you know, from Newham, we have a huge waiting list for housing, and it comes up all the time. But this access to housing and affordability is something that really, really concerns people. Now, there is always a pushback. People are always nervous about when there is house building going on. People generally don't like change, I think, is your starting point on anything. And so obviously there's always concerns you're going to lose green space. But actually, if you look, there is a huge amount of land that can be used and can be approached. And if we're a bit more innovative and thoughtful about how we do this, there is scope to do that. And I think a proper conversation on this is something that I think people will welcome. And, you know, it comes back to where we started this, really. It's about a fear of what's going to happen without properly engaging people. Mm-hmm. If you engage people and talk about what they want and how you might deliver that and have that conversation, some of those fears can be allayed, and you then get into a proper conversation about how we provide extra housing. So I think, actually, whilst there's a kind of knee-jerk reaction from the Tory backbenches, if they were having those conversations, they'd find that actually the demand probably outstrips that. And I think, you know, this is pushing an open door of what people feel, because everyone can see there is a huge problem.
No, absolutely. And the recent by-elections are anything to go by, and of course by-elections are sometimes isolated events, and the party may well have a mandate on a good day to carry through some of its proposals. And
So we're going to come to the asks for the next Mayor of London and the next government. But just quickly on that, you mentioned the date of the election, James Asser. Mm-hmm. Just curious, actually, James Beckles, would you, obviously seeking London Assembly candidacy and obviously thinking about Sadiq and wanting to, if you were to win the London Assembly, work with a Labour mayor, would you want the election to be on the same day as the mayoral election?
I think for convenience, yes. I'm just having it all, you know, at once and going ahead with it and just using that momentum just to push forward our policies and getting it over and done with. And I think the longer the Prime Minister delays and dithers, he probably does himself a disservice, really, and also does the country a disservice. You know, London and Britain need change, need certainty, and I don't think we have that. So having it in May, I think, would be a good option.
Okay. So, one ask for the next Mayor of London, whoever they may be, James Asser.
I think I would like to see better coordination between boroughs. I think we're really bad at actually working cross-borough. We're very much 32 places. And I think the City Hall and the Mayoralty could do to help coordinate that. And I think there's a role, actually, in terms of looking, as we get to 25 years of the London Assembly, looking at what powers it has and how it might do more coordination. So for me, I'd like to see us do more work between boroughs. I think we get often a bit too sort of localised and focused on our own patch and not a bit wider, and probably get some benefits from doing it.
And for me, it would be an improvement to infrastructure and also transport in east of London and also south as well. I think you know, what I guess debates around the Silvertown Tunnel will probably show is that there's a lack of infrastructure from the east of the capital, which I think would significantly impact positively the economics, the ability of people to get from A to B, north to south, a lot easier. So you know, it could be trains, it could be bridges, it might just simply be better motorways or active travel on bikes. But definitely infrastructure would be a key ask for me from the next mayor, whoever they may be.
And as someone who's lived in Enfield most of their life, I would certainly agree with you on better transport links into central London and actually crossing boroughs.
And then James Beckles, one ask for the next government?
One ask for the next government would definitely be let's sort out child poverty. I think it was a massive commitment of the last Labour government, reducing it. We've seen it increase on that. Newham, unfortunately, is afflicted by that. So I think reducing that, there's a lot that City Hall can do, but I think it can really be tackled by a national government effort to reduce that.
Narrowing it down to one is almost impossible, but given the focus of the podcast, what occurred to me is actually looking at how we do infrastructure in this country. everything takes too long, everything overruns. It's often too piecemeal. You know, you look at something like Crossrail, it's, you know, 35 to 40 years from someone having the idea to actually the trains running. We can't keep doing that. There needs to be a better kind of how we coordinate infrastructure across the country on a whole range of things. And I think a government grasping that would probably be long-term benefits for the country. So given the focus of this, that's where I'd go.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. And thank you, James Aston, James Beckles, for your time today. And I think just ending on that note, having a government that comes in with kind of new momentum, and of course I've got my own Labour bias there, will be something that bring positive change to the country. And we'll look forward to the rest of the year with even more guests from across London and the South East. Thank you.
Great. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mike.
Thank you.
Well, that's it from us. Thanks for listening to another episode of Better Places. Don't forget to like and subscribe on wherever you listen to this podcast, and we look forward to another episode soon.